So there's a book that I like to talk about a lot more, and that's the Bible. So if you have a Bible, turn to Daniel chapter 3. Daniel chapter 3. We were in Daniel chapter 1 earlier. Now we're in Daniel chapter 3. Before we get into that, let me talk about leading a revolution, because I talked to you about building an empire, and some of you took that to heart, I'm sure, and you want to now become an emperor of some group or some small nation or something that you plan on taking over. If you want to lead as an emperor to build an empire, you have to start with a revolution. Okay, all good empires need revolutions to overthrow current power systems. Hitler knew this. Hitler knew that it was going to be tough to win the German people over to fascism. So Hitler was actually democratically elected as German chancellor, but then he had a lot of work to do in convincing people that fascism was the way forward for Germany. But there's a lot of people, and a lot of them were very well educated, straight thinkers, ingrained in democracy as it stood, and so it was going to be very difficult. So he knew that he was going to have to be very creative in how he was going to get fascism into the hearts and minds, especially Nazism, of Germany, so that it would be won over. Well, he started in another brilliant idea was to start with youth. So he started with youth and started this thing called the Hitler Youth. And Hitler Youth was a movement that started very small. In fact, they were just kind of like a camp movement. They would just go out into the woods and then talk about Nazism and work through some drills. And those eventually became his core group. Every year, Hitler would be given, on his birthday, which they declared to be a German national holiday, he would be given about 10,000 more recruits into Hitler Youth. They would have these huge rallies, conferences we might call them today. They had a big band, the band would play loud music, and they would do marches in and a huge processional, and there was just so much hype. And then Hitler would be kind of the center speaker, and he would talk and he would share his future for a German that is united under fascism, under Nazism. And then slowly but surely, that's how he started to gain his tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and he would eventually take over Germany, and people would give their lives for Nazism. If you want to lead a revolution, you've got to start with youth. If you want to lead a revolution, you also have to squash any kind of resistance. And so Hitler set up a group called the SS. By the way, isn't this guy awesome? This is what resistance looks like. Everybody is doing one thing, but you are doing something totally different. You're not drinking the Kool-Aid, so to speak. And so guys like this in Nazi Germany would not last long. They would all of a sudden disappear. They'd be taken out. Sometimes they would be taken to concentration camps. Sometimes they'd be just shot directly. But Hitler had a group of people known as the SS who would do his dirty work in squashing any kind of resistance. Now let me say that this is not a new trick to start with youth and squash resistance. It was happening all the way back in ancient Babylon. We talked about how Nebuchadnezzar had this idea that he was going to set up an empire, and the way he was going to build it was by taking the best and the brightest students, training them to be good card-carrying Babylonians. They speak the language, they know the culture, they buy into the religion. And Daniel and his friends were recruited into this university. For 3 years they spent learning everything about what it meant to be a Babylonian. And they actually learned to thrive somehow. They maintained who they were. The Babylonians couldn't touch who their core identity was. We talked about that at first. And yet they were able to somehow thrive in this school, graduating top of the class, highest honors, promoted to very high in command in Babylon. One of the things that Nebuchadnezzar had to do was to rally people around common ideas. That's how you unify nations. You have a common story and you gather people around and you have these ceremonies where you remind people this is what's important to us. So it says in Daniel chapter 3 that Nebuchadnezzar created a statue. We'd call it an idol. Maybe it was 9 stories tall and 9 feet wide. So this isn't the exact picture, but probably something kind of like this, really tall and golden it was. And everybody was to gather, and it was like a conference that he would have outside of town. So about 16 miles south of Babylon in a place called the Plain of Dura, everybody was gathered from every level of government and society, and they were all to gather. And then it says when they heard the music play, you were given one instruction: bow down to the statue in worship to it as a way to unify everybody in Babylon. It was kind of that cultural thing that everybody got to be a part of, that song that everybody knew the words to, that experience that people could look back and say, I was a part of that. But for our Hebrew boys, for these teenagers who made this decision that they would not bow to anything other than God, they would serve no other gods, for there was no other gods that were real. There was only one true God, and that was the God Yahweh. This created a major problem. Some of Daniel's peers who would have graduated with him were likely threatened by the favor that they had. They were always getting better marks on the test. The teachers kind of liked them a little bit more, and they were given first promotion for new opportunities. So they go to Nebuchadnezzar, who's the mastermind behind this corporate rally, this worship, this big statue, and they say, did you know that there's four guys that are not bowing down to the statue? Did you know Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego won't take part in your public ceremony? Did you know that there's resistance? They found a crack in the empire, and it's a direct affront to you, O great king. Are you going to tolerate that kind of resistance? Because if you allow this to happen, this will be a sign of weakness, king. And you don't want these Hebrew boys exposing the weakness of your leadership, do you? Nebuchadnezzar actually gets a private meeting with these guys, pulls them aside and says, gentlemen, is this true? Is this really true that you will not just go along? I mean, just a little bow. Just bow a knee and come back up. At least let everybody see that you're on board. Just a little one. Little quick bow, you get back up. This is what happens. Nebuchadnezzar gives him a threat. Look, it's cute, but this is serious. Verse 15. This is Nebuchadnezzar's voice. If you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Nebuchadnezzar clearly has a power complex. And rightly so. He is the most powerful man in the world. And he's not to be discredited or ignored. When he says something, you do it. That's just how you be a good Babylonian. Now the power system is threatened. And this is what happens in verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. But even if he doesn't, we want to make it clear to you, your majesty, that we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue that you have set up. What powerful words. I mean, it'd almost be worth it just to stop there and mine some of those things that they've said, how they address this pagan king, this puppet of evil. And they're looking him in the face and saying, your majesty. It takes a lot of humility. It takes respect for a title that they believe God gave Nebuchadnezzar. They totally disagree with him, and yet they're willing to show respect to him. But they can't go against who they know that they are. They cannot violate their conscience that there is one true God, and that God is very clear. You shall have no other gods but me. Even if it's cool, even if everyone else is doing it, and even if there's great consequences for resisting to bow. Nebuchadnezzar's neck probably got a little red. Veins start popping out. How dare you usurp my authority? Do you know who I am? In fact, he wants to make a spectacle now that he will not allow this kind of weakness to be exposed. He is the most powerful. Remember, he asked the question, who is this God who will deliver you out of my hands? So he cranks up the heat 7 times hotter. In fact, it's so hot that he summons some of the strongest guys in the empire and says, take these guys and put them into the fire. But those guys themselves, it's so hot, they get too close and they're burned. Should be a warning sign to Nebuchadnezzar that the very symbols of his authority, these royal officials, those who got the closest to this fire, we're done. It should be a warning for him. Verse 20 in chapter 3, he ordered some of the strongest men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So they tied them up and threw them into the furnace, fully dressed in their pants, turbans, robes, and other garments. You say, what a waste of clothes. They knew they were going into the furnace. Why wouldn't he salvage some of their clothes? Maybe they were probably nice clothes. Why submit those to the fire as well? Throw them in naked and save a little cash. Put the clothes on Craigslist or Bidding Wars or something. Why the clothes? Why are the clothes mentioned? If he throws them in with their skin on, which they had their skin on, but just skin, the flames hit it, the boys melt, and it's done. Show is over. Put them in with all their clothes, and the clothes catch fire, ignite, and we've got a show on our hands now. We've got a public spectacle announcing that you do not mess with Nebuchadnezzar's power. You do what he tells you. You fall into line in Babylonian culture. Verse 23. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, securely tied, fell into the roaring flames. I mean, just imagine if you're reading this for the very first time, from a purely historical perspective. What do you think will happen to these guys? Another story of martyrdom, somebody dying for their faith. This is a tense moment if you're reading it with fresh eyes. So what's going to happen? But suddenly, Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in amazement and exclaimed to his advisors, didn't we tie up three men and throw them into the furnace?
Yes, your majesty, we surely did, they replied.
Well, look, Nebuchadnezzar shouted, I see four men, unbound, and walking in the fire unharmed. And the fourth looks like a god. Then Nebuchadnezzar came as close as he could to the door of the flaming furnace and shouted, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. What a confession. This is a different person now. Come out. Come here. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego stepped out of the fire. Then the high officers, officials, governors, and advisors crowded around them and saw that the fire had not touched them. Not a hair on their heads were singed, and their clothing was not scorched. They didn't even smell of smoke. I love that. Just in case you thought this was an old camping story, they didn't even smell like smoke. Remember the question that Nebuchadnezzar asked earlier. What God is going to save you from my hands? There's your answer. The God who is there with them in their time of crisis, in their time of confusion, in their questions, in their wonderings, in their suffering, in the middle of the fire, God is there with power to deliver them in their time of need. This is a great story. I learned it in Sunday school. I remember the flannel graph pictures and being all amazed that they were preserved. They didn't even smell like smoke, and you can act it out, and it's a cute little story, but I've since learned that this is not just a story for kids. This is a story for all of us who have ever felt the pressure to conform and do what everyone else is doing because it let us fit in, because we were able to get an edge, or because we weren't able to look silly. This is a story for those of us who have seen new high school curriculum and even elementary school curriculum coming out saying we're going to train our children to think a certain way when it comes to gender identity and appropriate expressions of sexuality. Have you seen those and said, I don't know what I'm going to do about this because I can't teach that. Or I can't do that kind of role play in good conscience. Everybody seems to be rallying around this common story, but I don't buy that story. And I can't accept it, and I can't celebrate it. I can study it. I can be a part of it, but I can't celebrate it. I can't just do what everyone else is doing. And I know that there's threats about losing my job or not getting a grade or being made fun of by my friends. Why can't you just do what everyone else is doing and think like we're all thinking and accept everything that we accept? And I realize that my phone will stop ringing and I won't be allowed a part of the inside jokes and I'll miss out on some of the fun. This is not just a kid's story. Christians today around the world know what it's like to be thrown into actual flames. We here in the West know that there's a certain kind of flame that's coming, a flame that comes when you stay true to your convictions, when you trust that what God said many years ago is still relevant today because God never changes. And when he says something, it stays true yesterday, today, and forever. That the tides of society do not dictate what is true. And we face consequences for not bowing down to the statue that everybody else seems to be readily accepting. So how do we make sense of this story? 6th century BC, brought into 21st century British Columbia BC. Let's process a couple of things. I want to talk about five. The first is this. Sometimes, when you enter into the fire, God can deliver you from it. Sometimes God can deliver you from the fire. I love the confidence of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Look, we're not going to bow. You can throw us into that fire. There's a strident confidence while they still are respectful to their authorities, submissive to their teachers. They know that there's going to be consequences for them, but they're not afraid of it. They say, God can deliver us from this fire. And they're not the only ones. You remember in Hebrews chapter 11, this is popularly known as the Hall of Faith, where the writer of Hebrews kind of goes through some of the heroes of the Old Testament, talking about people who showed great faith, who trusted God in difficult times. And then it gives this summary, covering a lot of ground in a few sentences. Verse 33 of Hebrews 11 describes some of the people that have been delivered from some fires. It says, by faith, these people overthrew kingdoms, ruled with justice, and received what God had promised them. They shut the mouths of lions, quenched the flames of fire, and escaped death by the edge of the sword. Their weakness was turned to strength. They became strong in battle and put whole armies to flight. Women received their loved ones back again from death. We'll pause there for a moment in the middle of verse 35. It's the middle. It's a hint. If you talk to any of those people, those who were saved from torture, those who overcame armies or silenced lions, took them aside and said, tell us about that. Like, what did you do? How did you navigate around that? How did you wipe out those whole armies with your very few limited resources? How did you stop the lions from eating? How did you save yourself from the fire? They'd say, it wasn't me at all. In fact, I thought I was a goner. I don't have any natural power to do that kind of thing. It's God. To him be the glory. He can do all things. He's the king over all kings. He's the Lord over all lords, and he's the Lord of all creation. Everything must submit to him and his authority and his power. I just trusted in him. They wouldn't give credit to themselves. They would point it to God, say, he's the almighty, powerful one. Sometimes God can deliver you from the fire. But point number two, we have to continue on in verse 35. Sometimes God doesn't deliver us from the fire. Look at Hebrews 11, the second half of verse 35. But others were tortured, refusing to turn from God in order to be set free. They placed their hope in a better life after the resurrection. Some were jeered at, their backs were cut open with whips. Others were chained in prisons. Some died by stoning. Some were sawed in half, and others were killed with the sword. Some went about wearing skins of sheep and goats, destitute and oppressed and mistreated. They were too good for this world, wandering over deserts and mountains, hiding in caves and holes in the ground. Oh, how different those two points are. Sometimes God delivers us from the fire, but sometimes he doesn't. This is just how God works, and we don't understand which one he's going to do. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they didn't understand either. Remember their words to Nebuchadnezzar, oh, King Nebuchadnezzar, your majesty, you could throw us into the fire, but God can save us. But even if he doesn't, we will not bow to your man-made fake statue. We could be thrown into that fire and burned to a crisp, and we will not bow. You can call me what you want. You can do whatever you want. You can take my life, but I will refuse to acknowledge that there is any God but my God, and I will not bow. And if he takes me now, then I'll get the joy of being with him then. You see, sometimes God doesn't. As a pastor, one of my favorite things to do is to baptize people. I don't know what it is, I think I do know what it is. It's because baptism is an outward expression of an internal life change already. So God does something in the human heart, and then we do a public expression of that. So we put people in the water, and we bring them out, and there's this big celebration because God is moving in that person's life. God is not silent. He is always speaking, and he is changing lives. I love baptisms. But I've learned after a few years that I have to have a conversation with people, usually in behind the stage before we go out there, because I've had to come to terms with the fact that sometimes when people get baptized, their life takes a turn in a way that I would only describe as awful. Sometimes they get sick. Sometimes their family members never treat them the same. Sometimes they lose a job. Sometimes they get sick, get mistreated, and lose a job. All kinds of bad things happen after people get baptized. So much so that I now take people aside and I say, look, by doing this baptism, you're publicly saying that you're going to identify with the life and death of Jesus. That you are dying to your sense of what is a successful life, what will make you comfortable, what will make you happy, what you want to pursue with your future, who you want to marry, everything. You're saying, all of this, I'm going down, and I am coming back up so that I embrace God's will for my life. And I say this, if God's will for your life is suffering from here on in, are you still willing to go publicly and say that you are going to be a follower of Jesus no matter what? No matter where he asks you to go, no matter what he asks you to do, no matter what happens, in sickness and in health, will you still follow Jesus? I have to have that conversation now in good conscience because that seems to be what happens. And after one gal came up to me and said, John, we got baptized. It was a happy moment, but then everything fell apart. I haven't been able to find a boyfriend. I lost my job. I've got Crohn's disease, and I'm out. I'm done. I don't want this. And I say this, when you said publicly that you're going to be a follower of Jesus and that anything, whatever happened to you, you want to be faithful to him, would that include this kind of suffering? Or did you just come to Jesus thinking that he was going to make you happy and give you everything you wanted? Because if so, we should have never put you in the water in the first place. So I tell people, are you going to try to dictate your terms to God? Say, I will only bow to you if you protect me from the fire. And if you don't protect me with that fire, then I'm going with everybody else to that crowd around the plain of Dura and bowing to that golden statue so I can keep a measure of control and success and happiness the way I want it. Are you going to dictate your worship to God as long as he gives you what you want? Sometimes Jesus saves you from the fire, sometimes he doesn't. Number three, there is a great reward for those who endure. Hebrews 11:13, these all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. There was a greater picture, an everlasting joy that awaited them on the other side of their death. Everybody in Hebrews 11 died at some point, but they died knowing that there was something better for them on the other side, where there was no more suffering and no more pain and no more tears, no more heartache, no more bullying. It was heaven. Verse 39 of that same chapter says, all these, though commended through their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something far better for us, that apart from us they should not be made perfect. There was something better on the other side. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not count their lives worth anything. Said, we are expendable. The one thing that matters is that we are right with God. And if we have that, you, King, do not have the power to take that away from us. You can do what you want with our bodies, but you cannot take what matters most. Number four, Jesus will always be with you in the fire. That's different than my point there. Jesus faced the only, there we go, number five. Let's go with that one. Number five is now number four, just in case you're wondering. Jesus will always be with us. Notice there was four people standing in that fire. What kind of a God is this, Nebuchadnezzar asks? He is a God who is not far off. He is not an idea. He's not a philosophy. He's not someone you just come to when you're in a good day. He's someone that's standing there with you in the fire. Jesus knows what it's like to be betrayed. He knows what it's like to be ignored. He knows what it's like to be misunderstood by family members. He knows what it's like to be spat on, to be humiliated, to be whipped, to be punched. He knows what it's even like to be separated from his Father. But unlike you and I, Jesus knows the most excruciating pain, which is to die on the cross and experience the sin of the world upon himself. And in that way, we'll never know that kind of suffering. But he is a God who suffers. He's familiar with suffering. And he can look at our suffering, and when we're standing there in the fire, crying out, calling out, saying, God, where are you? He's right there beside us, saying, me too. Nebuchadnezzar can't believe it. None of the gods in his whole pantheon would ever come and stand there in the fire. They're far off doing their own thing, completely unconcerned about the affairs of humanity. But God, the God of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, stands there with us in the midst of it. What a beautiful truth that Christianity offers. When we're suffering, we call out to God, and we don't have to call very far because he's there. The God of all comfort stands with us. If you have Jesus, lastly, you have nothing to fear. If you have Jesus, you have nothing to fear. Fear would have been Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego's probably greatest fear. I mean, they didn't have a lot of money. They didn't have their culture. They didn't have a lot of family to be connected with. But they did have their lives left. The good thing about Christianity, and the writer of Romans says that these heroes of the past, they looked forward to a day. They looked forward to the day that God himself would come and die, face death, take death upon himself, but then come on the other side and not stay dead, but show that he is victorious even over the power of death. And he rose to life. So that Paul responds to that in the letter to the Corinthians, saying, death, where is your sting? Where is your victory? Taunting death. He goes, death, na 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 boo boo, you can't get us anymore. We have nothing to be afraid of. Because why? Because our Redeemer lives. And Jesus said, because I live, you will live as well. And that is a great Christian truth. A truth that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego held on to in that moment when they were saying, we will go nowhere else but run to God. And you can do whatever you want with us, but we have a great joy awaiting us because our Redeemer, they didn't know it at the time that it was Jesus, but we do now that he lives. And because he lives, we have nothing to be afraid of. He defeated death. So how about you and your fires? Fires are interesting. We're either coming out of one or going into one or in the middle of one. It's kind of like a weekend, right? You're either in the middle of a weekend, you're coming out of a weekend, or you're going into a weekend. That's what fires of life are like. Jesus stands with you. But some people, it just seems like the fire is that much hotter, isn't it? Some of you have suffered far more than I ever have. And I can only say this. You need to decide now, if that fire doesn't end, or if it just keeps getting hotter, will you still worship? And even further, is God allowed to give you a very difficult, painful, confusing, doubt-filled, excruciatingly sad life today on earth to reward you with the eternal joys of heavenly bliss with him in heaven? Is God justified to give you that kind of pain, the sadness that only your heart knows, physical, emotional, relational, just over and over, you just can never seem to get out of the fire? Is God justified to give you that much difficulty and then give you heaven's joys forever with him? Yes. Yes, of course he is. Heaven's going to be amazing, and it's just going to keep going on, where every day is better than the one before. And all the sad things, C.S. Lewis says, become untrue. And all you have to do is endure and be faithful and do not bow to the God that everyone else seems to be going to for comfort or security or approval. If you endure, as the writer of Hebrews says, there is something far greater for you, and you hang on. It's my word to somebody. I don't know who it is today, but hang on, because heaven is going to be awesome. And you show the world that you will be faithful and that you will stand. But you never stand alone. You stand with the church, and you stand with Jesus. But you stand. Do not bow, my friends, no matter how hard it gets, because I've read the book, and we win in the end. Let me close with one story. I'm a big hockey fan. 2011 was a big year for me as a Canucks enthusiast. Like 94, we went all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals. We were actually ahead at one point. Before then, though, you may remember that we could not defeat the Chicago Blackhawks. 3 years in a row, they knocked us away. Or 2 years in a row, they knocked us out. The third year, it was getting a little bit tense. Canucks were doing well, but the game went into overtime. And it was back and forth, back and forth. And I remember watching that game. In fact, I was so stressed, I had to watch it by myself. I was saying things that no pastor should ever say. Sitting there alone, watching the game with my Canucks jersey on, shouting at the TV, just tense as anything. Alex Burrows flies down the right wing, lines up for a shot, slays the Dragon. Canucks move on to the next round. I thought that was our year, right? We didn't get it. But that's kind of known now as one of the great games of NHL history. Went into overtime, Game 7, Stanley Cup Finals. It just doesn't get better in hockey world than that. So they had this thing called an encore. I can't remember if it was TSN or ESPN, but I was just watching it one day, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. The Canucks versus the Blackhawks, Game 7 is on again. And I put that thing on, and I was watching it, and I was like, you know what? I'm enjoying this. This is quite carefree and peaceful. Oh, look, Chicago Blackhawks scored a goal. Let's see how this goes for you guys. Oh, look, they got a breakaway. I'm not too worried. Let's just put it in slow motion and watch our goalie Luongo make the save. Oh, look, there's Burrows. He's coming down the wing. Oh, I like where this goes. Carefree. I could have watched it with anybody. I could have had Gandhi beside me and Mother Teresa and Martin Luther King. We would have all been together. World peace. Hey, we won. Okay. I just told you two stories of the same game. But in one game, I was stressed because my team was going to lose. And it looked like it was going to be another disappointing outcome. And I was stressed. I was angry. And I did things that I regret doing and saying things I regret saying. And then I watched it again, knowing the outcome this time. And I was totally different. Humble, loving, kind, benevolent, and at peace. Sometimes when I see my own heart and I see Christians watching the world unfold before us, and we're like me watching that game the very first time, when we know the outcome, we know how this ends. Jesus wins. And yes, we do have trouble, but he has overcome the world. And he asks us to endure, and he asks us to stand, and he asks us to be loving of even our enemies, and to pray for those who persecute us. May God raise up people like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and may he use all of us until that day, and may we be faithful and stand and be courageous till the end. Let me pray for you. Thank you, God, that we have an example throughout history passed to us. Thank you that we too, by your grace and with your presence, we can stand and have courage under fire. God, I pray for anybody who's in the middle of it right now. May they sense that you are right there. You are the advocate, the one who comes alongside them, comforts and says, me too. God, give them an extra great measure of love. And those who are about to enter into a fire, don't even know it, Lord. Prepare us for it so that we can count it all joy when we face trials of many kinds. Jesus, we ask that you would heal our land, bring a new fresh wave of revival to Canada. But even if you don't, may we be faithful and true, standing true to our convictions and loving this world. And man, we look forward to when you come back, Lord Jesus. Help us to endure until then. In your name we pray. Amen.